not coming out alive!
Welcome to episode number 4 of the Stephen King Book Club podcast. Today is March 23rd. I am Sharon Hawkinson, and let's get started. First of all, I'd like to apologize for taking so long to get this episode out. We've had a number of things going on, and one of which included me getting a nasty cold. And so I've been hacking and sniffling, and I really didn't want to do a podcast with me sounding like a big frog, so I wanted to wait until I sounded like my old self again, so here I am, and we are up and rolling again, so I'd like to welcome everyone back. Okay, on today's agenda, we are going to do part 3 of The Green Mile, entitled Coffee's Hands, and I'm going to change the format just a little bit on here. There's actually 6 parts to this book, and I think we're just going to go ahead and do one part per section instead of just dividing it up into 5 or 6 chapters each time, because I think that'll help us get through the book a little faster. It'll make the podcast a little bit longer probably, but, you know, we've still got 3 parts to get through, and you know, we just don't want to spend forever on one book because there are a lot of other wonderful books to discuss, so hopefully doing it this way will work out a little better. Before we get into that, we do have some feedback that I want to read. This was on our website. I have also been emailing with Michelle from Illinois. I'd like to thank her for writing in, and I have, you know, definitely been enjoying email back and forth with you, Michelle. I appreciate you writing in and asking me if everything was okay. Like I said, it's been rather crazy, but yes, everything is fine, and we are back up and rolling, which is great. Our feedback that we got on our website, and this is just a little short note, which I'll read to you. I read The Mile a couple years ago, and of course, I saw the film. Great, both of them. We'll check the site out once in a while, waiting for the Tower 7. Cheers, Eleazar. And I do apologize if I pronounced that name incorrectly. So thank you for writing in. I do enjoy the feedback from you listeners. We now actually have 34 subscribers.
Alive! It's alive! It's alive!
And hopefully as the weeks go on, we'll just continue to grow and grow and grow. I would like to stress that, again, I would definitely like the feedback from all of you. We do have study questions that we put up on the website, and at the end of this podcast, I'll give you our website and my email and ways that you can offer your feedback and insights. But I do encourage you to write in and provide that. That way this podcast will be more interactive. All right, moving on to part 3 of The Green Mile, entitled Coffee's Hands. This part has 10 chapters in it, and we'll go ahead and go through this chapter by chapter here. In the nursing home, Paul watches Kiss of Death, starring Richard Widmark, on AMC. The character Widmark plays and how the actor looks reminds Paul of Wharton, and it freaks him out a bit. Are you surprised that Paul reacted this way? I don't believe I have seen this movie, but in this movie, Richard Widmark plays a gangster, and it apparently he really resembles how William Wharton looked when Paul had seen him in the prison. I am a little familiar with Richard Widmark because I'm a big old-time radio fan, and Richard Widmark played a gangster in one of the episodes. It was a radio show called Suspense, and this particular episode of Suspense, it was called The Spencer Brothers, and Widmark played one of the Spencer Brothers, who are outlaws, and it took place in the Old West. So I think this actor really did a lot of gangster roles and, you know, played the bad guy in that. But anyway, when Paul saw this movie, he just completely freaked out, and this was when his friend Elaine Connelly came up on him and asked what was wrong. I'm really not surprised that he acted this way, because I think what happened at this particular time with John Coffey and with Delacroix and everything, I think it really definitely affected him very deeply. And it's just something that he will carry for the rest of his life. And I'm sure we've all had experiences that we will never, ever forget and that just seem very, very vivid no matter how many years have gone by. I'm no big mastermind psychologist type, but I kind of think that maybe his reaction had a little bit of PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder syndrome type thing, just because he did have this very strong reaction. Back in those days when you had a very intensive job, I don't believe they had official debriefing sessions like they would now for, let's say, a rescue worker who was involved in, let's say, the Oklahoma City bombing or the 9/11 disaster or anything else that was real intense like that. I don't think people were very aware of the psychological fallout of something that would happen like this. So it didn't surprise me that he acted this way, but I think nowadays people are more aware of why somebody would have a reaction like that. Chapter 2. Wharton's attack on Dean continues in this chapter, and all hell breaks loose. Remember, at the end of part 2, it stopped when Wharton kind of went crazy and grabbed a hold of Dean, and then that part ended. And then, you know, this continues. And also, one thing I noticed in each part, the first chapter of each part takes place in the nursing home, it seems. And then the subsequent chapters, it flashes back to the actual events of what happens. So in this chapter, it just continues where the end of part 2 left off with Billy the Kid or Wild Bill, whatever, however you want to refer to him, attacking Dean and just going totally nuts. Okay. Wharton's attack on Dean continues in this chapter, and all hell breaks loose. Harry yells at Percy to hit Wharton, but Percy just stands there. Why doesn't Percy do anything? I've said this before in other episodes of this podcast, and I still believe this. Percy is just a big coward. He likes to play tough when he knows that he's got the upper hand, but I think in a real life and death situation, he's scared, he's a complete coward, and he really doesn't know how to act in something like that. Plus, you know, he's young and he's green, you know, which could have something to do with it too. And, you know, Paul and Brutal and the others are just kind of old hands at this, so they've seen stuff like this happen, although I think this was definitely one of the more violent ones because Dean's life was actually in danger. But I think Percy just stood there and didn't do anything because he is a coward. It certainly took everybody by surprise, but I think in a situation like that, to be a good prison guard, when something like that comes out, you have to sort of know how to react and how to bounce back from your surprise. And Percy just didn't do that. He just stood there just, you know, being a coward and just kind of, sort of like, duh. And it was actually Brutal that saved the day. Paul came out of his office and remember, he was feeling sick from his bladder infection, but it was actually Brutal who came around and smacked Wharton over the head with his baton and knocked him out cold. You know, they all looked down on Percy for that because he didn't even do anything. Chapter 3. This is the first time we see Coffey's powers at work when he heals Paul's bladder infection. What was your first impression of this? I had seen the movie before I actually read this book, and when I read the book and then remembered the movie, I really think the movie really characterized this so well because they did it in the way that I would totally imagine. Remember, John Coffey touched him, and anything he heals, he touches, and then he coughs up the black insects. It was described so well in the book, and then it was just so well done in the movie. When I had actually seen this in the movie, it just kind of took my breath away because I really wasn't expecting that. I don't know what I was expecting, but I certainly wasn't expecting that. In the movie, you know, when you see John just grab a hold of Paul, it's kind of like, uh-oh, you know, what now? And then when we find out what really happened, it's like, oh, wow, isn't that cool? So it was actually really cool. And then in the book, after reading the book, I actually knew it was going to be expected because I did see the movie, but it was described so well in the book. And I really loved how Stephen King described this so vividly and really described Paul's reaction to this. I think Coffey had a way of almost hypnotizing someone, because Paul knew that it was stupid to go near the cell and to actually unlock the cell, because it's just something that you just don't do. But he, you know, couldn't help himself. You know, it helped bring around the healing process, because Coffee actually had to make physical contact with him. When all this was happening, I was just on the edge of my seat. I mean, I just thought this was the coolest thing. Are there limits to Coffee's powers? And do you feel that Coffee is aware of any limits he might have? Yeah, there are definitely limits to his powers. We end up realizing this later on when we actually get the whole gist of what actually happened. In the beginning, when he's found with the girls, and he says, I tried to help it, or I couldn't help it, I tried to take it back. He's actually trying to bring them back, and it's too late for that to happen. They were just too far gone. And this is something that we come to find out later on in the book. Also later on, when Percy kills Mr. Jingles, John said something like, give him to me before it's too late. There might still be time. And I can't remember if that were the exact words either in the book or in the movie, but I do definitely remember that part. And there was another section in the book where Paul is actually thinking of putting the plan into action where he gets John to go and help Melinda. And he wonders if it's actually too big of a thing for him to handle. You know, is it too out of control for him to handle? And would it do any good? So there are limits. There are definitely limits. But does he realize it? I think with Coffee, he kind of thinks in the moment, because he does not really remember things that have happened to him in the past, and he was basically unable to verbalize what happened between the girls. He kind of forgets about things when they have gone into the past. His long-term memory, I don't think, is very good. And so I think as the moment arises, I think he understands that, yes, he can help. And in the moment when that happens, I think he realizes that there are limitations, because he does say stuff like, give him to me before it's too late. There might still be time. So when the situation arises, I think he understands that there's only a certain window of time. But thinking back on it, if he were to try to recall something that would happen last week, he wouldn't be able to. And he wouldn't be able to, you know, just tell somebody, well, there's limits to what I can do. I think with him, it's just all in the moment. Chapter 4. In this chapter, Paul goes to see Hammersmith, the reporter who wrote the news stories about Coffee. As they talk, Hammersmith explains about the dog his family used to have. The dog, for no apparent reason, attacked Hammersmith's son and severely disfigured his face, saying that the dog just had a mind to attack, as did Coffee. Hammersmith also agrees that Coffee is guilty of the murders he was charged with. Do you agree or disagree on both of these points? Why or why not? I have to disagree with Hammersmith. Of course, as the story unfolds, we actually find out that Coffee is not guilty, and it was actually Billy the Kid who did the murders. We don't really know what exactly happened to Hammersmith's dog. He just, for no apparent reason, just up and attacked the little kid. Hammersmith said that he was a good dog, and he didn't think that anything like that would happen, that he just up and did it. And he didn't want to take any chances that it might happen again, so he took the dog out and shot him. And of course, in those days, that was a common thing, I think. You just didn't, you know, take a dog to the vet and have him put down like we do now. I think deaths were a little bit more brutal and more violent back then. But we don't really know why the dog did this, and maybe it could be a number of reasons, and, you know, we'll never know. You know, the dog might have gotten some kind of neurological disorder and just kind of lost his mind temporarily and just did it, you know, without realizing what he was doing. So I actually did feel really bad for the dog too, and of course the kid. It was just a nasty set of circumstances that happened, and it was just, you know, kind of a sad part in the story for me anyway. But as I said, I do have to disagree with Hammersmith, because Coffee actually is not guilty. He firmly believed that Coffee was guilty, but Coffee was not guilty of the crimes. And Hammersmith believes that both Coffee and the dog just had a mind to up and do what they did. I don't really believe that. I think the murders of the girls were thought out a little bit. Of course, Billy the Kid is very dangerous, and he is definitely capable of doing something like that, as we see. But I think it was thought out. And as far as the dog, I really believe that the dog couldn't help it. So I think Hammersmith just really has a cynical view on things, and he's bitter about a lot of things, and which I guess in a way I can't blame him. I mean, you know, his son was hurt, and that would just send anybody into a depression or a feeling of bitterness, especially a severe disfigurement like that. So I think Hammersmith is just very cynical for reasons, and you can't really blame him. But I think he is, I definitely have to disagree on his way of thinking there. Chapter 5. Wharton stirs up trouble by peeing on Harry and then later spitting a moon pie in Brutal's face. On both of these occasions, he is hauled kicking and screaming into the restraint room. Do you feel that this chapter gives us comic relief, or is it helpful in giving us more insight as to Wharton's character? I think both. I think both, because there are things in this chapter that I actually did laugh out loud from. I love the sarcasm of the guards when Wharton did all this stuff, and, you know, just the things that they said to Wharton after all this was going on, and when they were hauling him to the restraint room and that. I really loved that. I just, you know, just the Weisenheimer remarks just cracked me up. In a way, it was kind of funny. I mean, it was disgusting, you know, for Harry and definitely for Brutal. I mean, it was very disgusting. We do know that Wharton is actually very dangerous. I mean, his attack on Dean proved that. And when we find out about the murders and that, I mean, we do know that he is very dangerous. But in this chapter, he stirs up trouble, not by doing dangerous things. I mean, they are very gross. I guess in a way, it's more like small fry stuff compared to what he did to Dean. But in a way, it was funny. In the previous chapter, you know, we had something real intense, you know, with Paul and Hammersmith talking about coffee and then about the dog. And then we get this chapter, and it's a little lighthearted, although parts of it were icky. But it was a little lighthearted, especially, I think, with the guards making the comments and the wisecracks to Wharton when they were hauling him down there. And I really loved how Harry got the water hose and just squirted him. And this was so well done in the movie. And reading the book and then watching it in the movie, I mean, I did have to laugh. And actually, I think in the movie, it was actually Paul that got the moon pie thing. But in the book, it was Brutal. So that was done a little differently, I think. But I think it did serve as comic relief because parts of it were funny. But also, it does give us a little more insight on Wharton's character. We do know that he is dangerous, and we do know that he is not above starting trouble of any kind. He's very creative about the trouble that he makes. I think it was, I can't remember which of the guards said it, but the moon pie, they did say that the moon pie thing was very original, and they have seen a lot of stuff. So I think this chapter served as both purposes as far as giving us an idea more of how Wharton is and how he operates, and to give us something to laugh at. Stephen King is definitely good at that. Even with all the intense things, with all the intense stuff, he definitely knows how to give us something to laugh about. And he definitely does have a sense of humor, a very different sense of humor, but it is funny. Chapter 6. Paul and Janice go to see Melinda, and it saddens them to see her in the condition she is in. During and after this visit, Paul thinks about coffee and what his powers can do. Do you think Paul realizes that he is actually considering somehow making it possible for coffee to help Melinda? If you've read the book and seen the movie, you actually know what's going to happen. Paul actually does bring coffee to Melinda's house to help her. Coffee does enter Paul's mind because Melinda is seriously ill with this brain tumor, and coffee does have these miraculous healing powers. And it's kind of like he's not put two and two together yet, but his mind, the wheels, you can just kind of hear the wheels turning as all this is going on. When Paul is actually thinking about coffee and what he can do, the wheels are actually clicking and turning. But I don't think yet he realizes what he is actually gonna plan to do. We don't really see that until a little bit later on. I think in the back of his mind he's considering it, but it's not quite there yet. Again, Paul thinks about Del's execution and Percy's attitude toward this particular prisoner. Paul's sense of foreboding does not go away. Does yours? Nope, mine doesn't. You know, ever since I read and saw in the movie where Percy was going to be permitted to be out front for this execution, I just knew something was up. I just knew that Percy was going to be up to something because he hates Del and he wants revenge, especially after Wharton grabs him and literally scares the pee out of Percy and Del laughs. I think that was just a straw that broke the camel's back. And I just, you know, ever since all this was going on and we find out that Percy is actually going to be out front during this execution, we just know that he's up to something and it's not going to be pretty. Chapter 7. Del's execution is drawing closer, and the rehearsals must be carried out. Del and Mr. Jingles are taken to Mr. Anderson's office, so Mr. Jingles can show him and some others his tricks. This seems to serve as a distraction for Del in order to keep him as unalarmed as possible. Do you think Paul and the others feel sorry for Del? Do you think they would extend themselves like this to other prisoners? I think Paul and the other guards have come to like Del. They're not excusing the crimes that he did. They're not excusing the murders and that he committed. And I think they do feel that he probably does deserve to be on death row. But, you know, I think they do feel sorry for him. He's not really the smartest person ever. I imagine he's probably got a pretty low IQ. But yeah, I do believe that they feel sorry for him. And especially with the way Percy had been treating him. And that, and Del is just, you know, the way he was acting, I mean, he was just a scared little mouse himself, especially when it came to Percy. I think they felt that he deserved to, you know, not to be as scared as he could have been, and, you know, they wanted to give him a distraction, and I also felt sorry for Del. You know, he was just a neat character. I did like him, although he was a murderer, and he did deserve what he got. Not the brutality of it, but you know, the sentence that, you know, that he got to be sentenced to death in Old Sparky. But still, I did feel sorry for him. And the second part of the question is, do you think the guards would extend themselves to other prisoners? Well, obviously, they extended themselves to Coffee. And, you know, they treated him well. I think if it was somebody that they liked or somebody that they saw that maybe they could help, I think they would. Obviously, they wouldn't do any favors for Billy the Kid, because Billy the Kid was just a big scumbag. But I think if it was somebody that they liked and that they felt compassion for, yeah, they would do all they could to help him. Chapter 8. Paul feels that the rehearsals for Del's execution have gone well, and that Percy is actually performing up to scratch this time. Do you think Paul feels better about the situation, or is he still feeling uneasy? Do you feel uneasy, or do you think things will go well? I think Paul is still feeling rather uneasy about the execution, because he doesn't trust Percy, and I don't think any of the others do either. I think they were happy that Percy performed satisfactorily at the rehearsals, but I still think that in the back of their minds, especially in Paul's mind, I think he knows that Percy is definitely going to pull something. And so the uneasiness doesn't go away. And my uneasiness doesn't go away. I think Percy is still definitely biding his time. And we see that on several occasions. And I think he's just waiting for the opportunity to get his revenge, especially after Del laughs at him for peeing his pants when Billy the Kid grabbed him. And this is what we're going to be getting into next. Percy walks too close to the cells after everyone comes back from rehearsing for Del's execution, and Wharton grabs him. It terrifies Percy, and he wets himself. Del laughs, and Wharton harangues him. Percy is utterly humiliated. Do you think he overreacts? Do you think this spurs on Percy's hatred for Del? Knowing that the kind of person that Percy is, I can definitely see him acting this way, threatening everybody and just being just absolutely humiliated, because he is a big bully and he likes to be on the top cloud. And anything that just would embarrass him, anything that would just make him look like a, you know, a butthead, he would definitely not like. And of course, Dell and the others would get a big charge out of it, especially Billy the Kid, too, because, you know, he was the one who actually, you know, grabbed him and, you know, and scared the living, you know, wet out of him. So, yeah, of course, I mean, they're going to get a big charge at Percy's expense. And sure, it would be embarrassing to pee your pants, you know, and as nasty as that is and unfortunate, really, it was Percy's fault because he walked too close to the cell and he should have known better. This definitely spurred on Percy's hatred of Dell. Percy didn't like Dell in the first place, and the fact that Dell laughed at him in a very embarrassing situation for Percy, the fact that Dell laughed at him was the straw that broke the camel's back, as I had said previously. And if Percy wasn't going to get revenge then, I think this really cemented the fact that he wanted revenge and that he wanted to teach Dell a lesson and to carry out the threats. You know, you don't laugh at me and you don't embarrass me. And so I definitely think that the hatred definitely escalated that way. The event that happens next is perfect evidence of that. Chapters 9 and 10. I put these together because chapter 9 was a shorty and not really too much happened. Paul was just out in the exercise yard talking with Bill Dodge in chapter 9. It is the night before Dell's execution, and Paul is talking to him about what will happen. Dell is more worried about what will happen to Mr. Jingles, and it's finally decided that the mouse will go to Mouseville. Do you think that Dell believes that there is such a place? I think Dell's belief is genuine. I think it was Brutal who brought up the idea of Mouseville, and of course it's a fictional place. But I think Dell believes, I really do think that Dell believes that there actually is such a place, and this leads up to his throwing the spool excitedly and then Mr. Jingles running out to get it, which led to Percy doing what he did next. As I had said, I think Dell has a low IQ, and in some ways I think he is very gullible, and so he bought into the Mouseville thing. And I think he really wanted to believe that there was such a place so that Mr. Jingles would be happy and that he could go to his death knowing that Mr. Jingles was going to be taken care of. As they are talking, Mr. Jingles gets out of Dell's cell and retrieves the spool. Percy then steps on him and kills him, saying, "I knew I'd get him eventually." Who is the him that Percy refers to, Dell or Mr. Jingles? What do you think possessed Percy to do such a thing? And again, Mr. Jingles got out of the cell to get the spool because Dell threw it rather hard and it bounced off the wall and then rolled out of the cell. And that's when Mr. Jingles went to get it, and that's when Percy stepped on him. The he that Percy refers to, I think he could mean both of them. I think directly he meant that he would get Mr. Jingles eventually, because earlier in the book, he actually chased the mouse into the restraint room trying to get him. And he also knew that by harming Mr. Jingles that he would really, really upset Dell and would be able to get some kind of satisfaction, revengeful satisfaction as far as that goes. So indirectly, he probably meant Dell. Well, I got Mr. Jingles, so I got Dell too. I think in a way he meant both of them, but I think directly he meant Mr. Jingles. And what possessed Percy to do such a thing? Revenge. He hated Dell to begin with, and then when Dell laughed at him, I think it was just his way of getting back at Dell. Percy knew that by harming Mr. Jingles that would be the thing that would hurt Dell the most. In our next podcast, we'll move into part 4, which is entitled The Bad Death of Edouard Delacroix. Again, as I said at the beginning of the podcast, I would definitely welcome your feedback, answers to our study questions, and then what feedback I receive, I will read that on the next show. So if you'd like to be mentioned on the show, please supply some feedback and answers to our questions or any other insights about the book that you might have or anything about the show that you'd want to say. You can email your comments, answers to the study questions, or anything to me at sweetnightingaleus@yahoo.com. I'll spell that. It's sweetnightingaleus@yahoo.com. Our study questions and some show notes will be on our website, and our website is www.stephenkingbookclub.blogspot.com. It's set up as a blog, so you can leave comments on the website directly. Another way that you can leave feedback is I have a voicemail number that you can call if you'd like to leave a voicemail message, and then I can put your lovely voice on the show so you won't be hearing me yap at you the entire time. That number that you can call for that is 206-350-2613. Again, that's 206-350-2613. When you email, please include the word podcast in your subject line. That way it will be filtered into my folder for the podcast. When you're leaving a voicemail message, please specify that this is for the Stephen King Book Club podcast, because I do use that number for several things. So until next time, this is Sharon Hawkinson signing off and wishing everyone happy reading.
Yeah.